Today's episode of Rob as a Podcast is sponsored by TrueCar. Now, it can be difficult to find clarity when you're searching for the price of a new car on The Price is Right, but it can never be difficult to find clarity when you're looking for the price of a new car when you're on TrueCar.com or the TrueCar mobile app, because with TrueCar, you could punch in all the features that you want in that car and you could see what other people are paying down to the zip code. You could be El Cheapo when you see what other people are paying for that car, and you could be getting that same exact deal, because with TrueCar, people are saving an average over $3,000 off of MSRP without any of the hassles or the headaches associated with shopping for a new car. It's how car buying was always meant to be. And with over 2 million cars sold in the TrueCar certified dealer network, you know that there's a car out there waiting for you. There's over 10,000 dealers in the TrueCar certified dealer network. You can work directly with a TrueCar certified dealer when you visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app and start saving. TrueCar, never overpay. Hey, everybody, what's going on? Rob Cicerino back here with a fun podcast, I believe, today, because we're going to be talking about something that is very near and dear to my heart, and that is game shows. Before I became somebody who was obsessed with reality TV shows, there were game shows, and throughout all of my childhood, that was really what I was watching. Not like my kids or my son Dominic, who is watching Nick Jr. and Netflix and YouTube and all these things, that he has basically any show he wants to watch on demand. I had to watch certain things that were on TV in the morning. And really, more so than cartoons, I fell in love with game shows and really helped turn me into the awkward person that I am today. And some people here on the show today are also people that were probably in some way, shape, or form raised the same way, with a love of game shows. And they, instead of going on a reality show, decide to follow their passion onto quiz shows. And they're here with us to discuss their experiences. Let's start with the man who actually came up with the idea for this panel. All these people you've heard before on RHAP at one point or another. Let me welcome in Scott Green. Scott has been on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and is an avid quiz show follower. He was on the podcast last summer to talk about the show 500 Questions. And of course, he is also an avid fan of The Genius and host of the Genius Cast podcast. Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you, Rob. Let's forget that I said 500 questions would never be back. Can you take that out of the podcast a year after it came out, or is it too late?
No, we cannot remove things from the podcast ex post facto. So Scott Green came up with the idea for this podcast and said, why don't we talk to these people and talk about some of these shared game show experiences? And we'll hear more from Scott about what his experience was like on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Also joining us here on the panel, she is my co-host for all things Amazing Race here on Rob as a Podcast. She has also in another life been a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Jeopardy. Welcome back, Jessica Leese. Jessica, how are you?
Well, Rob, I didn't know where you were going with the intro. I know you were talking about how watching game shows made you awkward. And then you said, and I'm here joined here with three people. And I thought you were going to finish that with who are even more awkward than I am.
No, impossible. Impossible.
But Jess, I don't know. I've given you a run for your money.
Excited to talk about your experiences on the game shows today. And also here with us today is a person who is on I wouldn't necessarily call it as much of a quiz show as much of a game show, but my favorite show of all time before we got to Survivor or any of these things. Brent had a chance to do something that I never got to do, which was appear on The Price is Right. You know Brent from all of his work on the Big Brother podcast. Also, he does YouTube shows about gambling, so he knows all sorts of gaming stuff. Here is Brent Wolgemut. Brent, how are you?
Rob, it's so nice to talk to you again, and I am so excited. I must say, it's so nice to meet Scott, but I have never been on a podcast with Miss Jessica Leese before, and I am loving it already. I can hear the sarcasm from here in Kentucky.
All right.
Well, that's a great start.
is that sarcasm?
I love it. Yes, I love her. She tickles me.
Well, thank you, Brent, for the nice compliment. I do appreciate it.
All right. So I thought this would be very fun once Scott suggested it, to talk about how to get on game shows and what your experiences were like. And then we have some questions as well to sort of go through this. So I will be asking you guys any questions that I've had sort of going through. But maybe before we get into it, is it an assumption on my part to assume that you guys all had a same sort of background of that you started watching these game shows as a kid and it was sort of like a bucket list type quest to get on one of these shows, Scott?
I remember back in kindergarten coming home every day in time for Jeopardy at 3:30 in Chicago, and sitting and watching with my mom and being so impressed. She knew so many answers and keeping track of like who the winners were and how long the streaks were and picking my favorite contestants. So it goes as far back as I remember watching television for me, wanting to one day be able to do that, to sit on the couch and impress my kids. And, I don't think he's impressed, but I just think he thinks that the contestants on TV are repeating what I just said, so it's nothing that special.
Jess or Brent?
I can tell you that I was a game show obsessed nerd when I was a kid. I mean, Rob, you and I have talked about this offline. I literally like forced my parents to play game shows with me when I was younger, and I would like, you know, set up boxes for like the $25,000 pyramid and put subjects on them. Like even at like 7, 8 years old,
yeah,
I understood how the game worked and, you know, why you could give some clues, but you couldn't give other clues. And, you know, I would like, I mean, literally growing up in the 80s, I mean, that's all there was on weekday TV was, you know, Super Password and Pressure Luck and Price is Right and Pyramid and Hitman and Dream House and, you know, and all these other game shows that I literally are a part of my lifeblood. So that's what got me into Survivor and reality TV. And then I think it just sort of morphed into my love of all things slot machines in my life.
And Jess, how about you?
I think it's a very similar story, although my entry was not necessarily because I liked the game show. It was that I liked the trivia, because I watched Jeopardy from pretty much season one. I think I was about 5 years old when Jeopardy came out.
And the reboot of Jeopardy.
Yeah, the reboot of Jeopardy, not the Art Fleming Jeopardy.
Right.
I'm not that old.
Trebek Jeopardy.
Yeah, Trebek Jeopardy, which is Best Jeopardy, came out when I was very small. So I grew up watching it. And by the time I was like 6 or 7, every so often there'd be a question that I would get right. And then by the time I was 10, I was routinely getting more correct than my parents. And so this was really wanting to go on the quiz show was not so much I wanted to be on television. I just wanted to play the game.
Now, you said it was more about the trivia than the game. So are you saying that you would have played it if there weren't cameras there, or you just were really interested in answering questions and you didn't care in what format that was going to be?
Oh, hell yeah. I would have played that game if it wasn't on television.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was on the president of the Quiz Bowl team in my college. Like I did as much competitive trivia as I could for a long time. So
yeah, I did too, actually. So I did the spelling competition and the Quiz Bowl competition. I mean, I think we all did all of that sort of stuff. We just loved it. Yeah.
Yeah, 4-time Geography Bee champion.
Thank you. Yes.
Now, is that something about a certain generation, like kids that are growing up now, to make us and myself especially sound very old? Is that as much of a thing for kids growing up now in an age where all information is available, you know, on your phone at any point in time? Scott, do you think that the kids that are growing up now are going to be as interested in quiz shows?
Yeah, I think quiz shows are going to remain as the pure form of it. That these people don't need their cell phone in their pocket. These are the people you can call to settle a bar bet when the wireless signal is down. That, you know, and you can use it to make a lot of money too, and that has timeless appeal.
Okay.
The quest of, hey, maybe I could go win a lot of money. I'm going to watch these people win money. Money is interesting too, and that heightens everything.
People are still going to be greedy no matter what the time.
There's still shows that don't require skill that are all about money, and people watch those just as avidly as they watch Jeopardy and Millionaire.
Okay. So like what? Give me an example of that.
Deal or No Deal?
Are people avidly watching Deal or No Deal?
They were.
It was huge for a while, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's doing fine in the ratings, Rob. I don't see it getting canceled anytime soon.
Why, it's on in syndication?
It's not still.
Deal or No Deal?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it's still on. I think it's done in syndication, yeah.
I had no idea. I'm not a Let's Make a Deal fan, so I thought it was doing fine.
We're saying Deal or No Deal, not Let's Make a Deal.
Yeah.
Deal or No Deal. I'm sorry. I'm thinking Let's Make a Deal. Sorry.
No.
Let's Make a Deal is still on.
The models.
Okay.
Jeopardy has a little bit, Jeopardy in particular, and Millionaire to a lesser extent, has a little bit of like why we watch pro sports. Like I love to watch NBA basketball, to watch like the best in the world do this amazing thing that they can do and I can't. And with Jeopardy, for me, it's more accessible because I can do those things. I think I've passed the test. Jess, you've done it, so you know. But to watch people who are unbelievable at trivia, better than most people could ever dream to be, doing this, performing this amazing skill. So it's a little bit of that and more of a, like, that could be me sort of way. Because I can't be 7 feet tall, but I can ring a buzzer and I could maybe get an answer that Ken Jennings doesn't know.
True. But there's also, I think, going beyond that, a lot of people I know watch it. And I guess this speaks more to the people I keep company with. But a lot of people watch shows like that, not just to feel like they themselves could be up there, but to feel superior to the people that are on the show.
Right. That's what I was going to say was, like, I mean, we're all show offs. I feel like all four of us on this panel are show offs. I know I am. And I love to, like, let people know, you know, I got the answer on Wheel of Fortune before y'all did and I won. So, I mean, I feel like that's an element that's coming to the surface when we're all trying to get on these shows. We want to show that we are the best and we can do what these people on this show can't do, which is win.
Now, a great point. So everybody is saying, everybody that has a love of these things, they all want to be on the show. They all want to show off what they can do. But you were people, all three of you were people that set out to actually make it happen and weren't just people that were talking about it. Now, Brent, for The Price is Right, I know that's a little bit of a different story in terms of casting than a show like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or Jeopardy. So let me just start with the longer format, which is casting for one of those shows. Jess and Scott, how did you guys go about going into casting on a show like that? Like, what was the application process like?
Well, Jeopardy now starts with an online test, which actually is this week. So depending on when you're listening to this, the Jeopardy test is the 26th, 27th, and 28th in the evening, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So you can log on to Jeopardy.com and hopefully it's not too late to sign up.
And how does that work? You have to take it at a certain scheduled time or is it just you fill out the quiz in a...
There's a scheduled time each night because once the quiz is out, then people would be stealing answers. You get 15 seconds per question. There's 50 questions in 50 different categories. They've never announced what the passing score is, but rumor has always been it's 35 out of 50. And if you do well enough on it, you get entered to be selected for a live in-person audition where they give you another 50 question test to make sure you weren't cheating. And then you play a live version of the game. And I've been through this process many times. So I can tell you about the process, but I can't tell you about how to beat the process because I've not been on Jeopardy, but Jess has.
Jess, what was it like when you went through the process?
Well, I was on, it's now going to be 10 years ago.
Wow.
So there was no online test because we didn't have computers. We had computers. We didn't do the online test.
Right.
And in order to get on the show, you had to put your name in a hat and get randomly chosen to take the test. And I had done that many times, but it wasn't until I knew someone who had been on the show before and they asked her, who do you know that would be good to take the test? And she gave them my name. So I got to go. It was basically like skipping the online test portion entirely. And they just like pick random people to go into a room and take the 50 question test and do the buzzer thing.
The big difference, though, I don't know if you just skipped the test, but at least in those days, in the pre-online test days, they'd have a room of 100 people. Because I've been
there. Oh, yeah.
And out of those 100 people, they do the test, the 50 question test, and they read off the names of people who passed. And 94 of those people would shuffle out of the room disappointed that they had not passed the test.
That was exactly my experience.
And where were you? Was this, Jess?
This was in New York City. Okay. This was at that ugly hotel on 42nd Street. It's like a Hyatt or something. It's like next to the big movie theater. And I had to go into a conference room and take this test. And yeah, the pass rate was, it was less than 10% of the room passed the test. And then from that group, we had to, you know, pass the personality portion. And the personality portion, I gotta be honest, the number one best thing you can do to get on Jeopardy if you're good at trivia is be a woman under 30.
Mm. Yep.
And like in the room, or
someone of color also is good.
Yes. In mm-hmm. my room, there were three women under 30, and we all three made it to air.
Yep. Yeah, Jeopardy wants, every new episode, they have two new contestants. They always want one male and one female, but the ratio of men to women who apply is crazy. It's like, it's probably like 5 to 1. And in terms of, like, you know, they want a few minorities represented every week. So if you're a minority, you can pass the test. Your chances immediately go up. If you're a boring middle-aged white guy, I hope your hobby is interesting.
Yeah, the guy that beat me the day that I played, that I was actually on the show, his most interesting story about his life was that he met his wife on the internet.
Oh,
right. Well, I remember watching your episode. Yes.
There's a lot of that though. I mean, and Jess, you can attest to this, but in the Jeopardy room, when they're interviewing people, you fill out a form with five interesting things. So when Alex eventually interviews you, they have, I think you have to update the list before you go on the show.
He picks one,
right? So it's not, he's not like guessing like, so you're a fly fisherman, you know, he knows because you provided the list. So the contestant coordinators are giving you something off your list. And sometimes the most interesting thing they'll find are the people applying. One of them was like, you know, they always ask you what to do with the money. What do you do with the money? What do you do with the money if you win? The one girl was like, I have a lot of message board friends and I would try to visit them and stay at their houses. And, you know, it's like, that's not a Jeopardy story. You know, like people have stories that just aren't, they're not TV stories. So you give yourself a big leg up by having a story that's interesting, something to do with the money that's interesting. All these shows ask what you do with the money. Have something good. Don't say you'll save it. You know, you got to say, well, I'm going to go to every single football stadium and see my team play everywhere across the country. Something interesting.
Yeah, well, I think, and this speaks to, I think the larger thing you can do to get cast on any of these shows, I think boils down to, what is your elevator pitch? Like, what can you say about yourself in 10 seconds that's going to make these people like you and want to put you on television? And I got onto Jeopardy on my first try. Like, I was not terribly surprised about that because I figured if I pass the test, this is a demographic they want. Wants to Be a Millionaire, I tried out twice. And the first time I passed all the tests, but I failed the on-camera portion. And I thought, I need to kind of take a cue from everything I know about reality TV and about casting. And I need to figure out, you know, what am I going to say to them that's going to make them go, wow, that's really cool. And
right.
I figured out what the thing was. And I told them the thing. And they were like, oh, my God.
And what was it?
I told them about, like, at the time I was training pretty seriously as a competitive boxer, and I was training for the Golden Gloves at the time. And I said, you know, I'm an amateur boxer and I'm training for the Golden Gloves. And they're like, whoa, because don't look like it.
Yeah, so. That's like straight on the show. The Millionaire is a different trial process. Millionaire still does the in-person thing. You're in a room, it's way more people than Jeopardy. When I took it, I did it three times. So the third time when I got on, it was at a casino. They had like a big room rented out in the casino. They had, I think, 300 people in for the test. You get a Scantron, like an old school Scantron, like you had in high school. There's a sheet of paper with 30 multiple choice questions on it. You answer them all. There's no penalty for guessing wrong. You have like 10 minutes to do these 30 questions. So you got to be fast. And then they scan them and they read off the numbers of the people who passed the test, which is, again, about 10%. And then those 10% go fill out a form about, it's a huge questionnaire. Jeopardy says, tell us five quick, brief, interesting things. Millionaire has like an 8-page, like long answer form, but they want to know what would people say about you? What would you do? Again, what would you do with the money? You know, what are your hobbies? What are your goals? And they want to try to find something interesting. So you fill that out. Then you meet face to face with a contestant producer. In Jeopardy, you're going up in groups of three and like playing a mock version of the game in front of the room. But Millionaire, it's just you and the producer across the table, and then if they like you at that point, then they send you to the room with the video camera and they tape you answering a few questions.
Jess, let's just talk through that Jeopardy game, and then let's try to because I know you guys each have a story, but I feel like it would be best to try to keep the stories together. Jess, so you find out you're going to get on Jeopardy, right? And then what do you do to prepare to go on Jeopardy?
The biggest thing, like with trivia, I feel like, especially with quiz shows like Jeopardy and Millionaire, you're not going to learn the piece of information that's going to come at you on the show that's going to make the difference between winning or losing. Everything about the show is down to luck and down to how much is already in your brain. So right out the window, I didn't study, like not in the conventional way. But what I did do, the thing that you can practice, that you can learn about Jeopardy, is practicing the buzzer. Because there's a specific way that the buzzer is timed. And they actually gave us pens that were roughly shaped like the Jeopardy buzzer. And they said, go home and practice this. And you watch the show and get used to reading the question faster than Alex reads it. And then there is a beat of half a second. And then there's a light that comes on. And that's when you can buzz in. And if you buzz in earlier than that, it locks you out for half a second. So what is really important is to watch the show and get a sense of the timing. Like, wait for Alex to finish and find the right spot to ring in, and then you ring in as fast as you can. You don't just hit it once, you hit it a bunch of times in hopes that you're the one that gets the answer. And in the end, like, I practiced that every day for 3 months, and the guy that beat me, I knew everything he knew. He was just a little bit better on the buzzer.
Now, just to back up a step, when you find out that you're going to be on the show, what's that like getting the call? I certainly know what it's like to go through that with the reality TV process, but do they just call you up out of the blue, or do they tell you in person when you're there to do the auditions?
No, they call you, and it's a long process. You don't know when they're going to call you, because they usually call you like a couple of months out. I think I got a month advance notice, and then they had to push that back because Alex was injured or something.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But they give you like a few weeks of lead time, and you're in the contestant pool for a year. So anytime during that year, you could get the call. And they called me at work, and they're like, yeah, this is the guy from Jeopardy. And he left a voicemail. So I wasn't even there when he called, and I'm freaking out, like trying to get a hold of them. And I was like, having to sit there, they're not picking up their phone. I have to wait for them to call me again. It was very nerve-wracking, but you know, it was exciting, but it was more like, yeah, this is something I've always wanted to do, and now I'm going to get to do it. How cool was that?
And they fly you out and they take care of, they put you up?
No, they do not actually.
Oh, wow.
For Jeopardy, you have to get there on your own expense and you have to stay there on your own expense, but you get at least $1,000 for appearing on the show.
Okay.
And they figure that's enough to cover your expenses.
Jeopardy only pays to fly out people coming in for tournaments. So if you're in the tournament of champions, well, then they'll fly you out.
Also, if you are on, like they film 2 days a week. And so if you win a whole bunch and you have to come back the following week, they will fly you out in that case. Like Ken Jennings, they flew him out on their dime a bunch.
Back and forth.
Yeah. But I got second place on my Jeopardy episode. So I was a little bit better than breaking even. I had enough left over that I could take a class at the new school the following summer. So I felt like that was a win.
Okay. Now we have links for a lot of this stuff that we're going to talk about in this podcast. And I have a link to, there's a site called j-archive.com, which is the archive of your Jeopardy game. Which shows all of the questions that were asked on your show and that you got right. The categories.
Rob, check that out. How many questions did I get wrong, Rob?
You know what? I'm not familiar enough with the site to be able to give you that information. No,
that's not bad. 15 right, 0 wrong. That's not bad. Yes. I will say that I knew the final Jeopardy answer that you didn't, but I will also say that everybody who you've talked to about Jeopardy has told you that they knew the answer to that.
Yes,
and you want to punch every last one of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've been dealing with this for a decade now. People ask, what is the question? Oh, I knew that one. And 25% of the time they know it. And 75% of the time they're just being dicks.
Well, people always want to, like, if they get the one that you got wrong, then as far as they're concerned, they're smarter than a Jeopardy person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You got a pretty lame final Jeopardy. I would have probably left right at the point where I heard that the final Jeopardy category you had was British monarchs. Now, according to this, you came into Final Jeopardy. You had $8,000. Ed had $12,600, and Mary was a disaster. Grease fire, minus $1,400 for Mary.
Well, yeah, but Mary had won like $30,000 the day before, so nobody feels sorry for Mary.
But the category was British monarchs, and the answer was the last British king not named George, William, or Edward was named this. I have no idea.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's a good like wheelhouse Final Jeopardy question.
Was it Henry?
No, it's James. You got to go all the way back.
I went back too far. Was my mistake.
What'd you say, Jess?
I said Richard, and I was just because I don't know British history. I was an American history major, and since then, I've read tons of stuff about this stuff, and ironically, every time it comes up, I think, man, I would have known this now, but you know, hindsight's 20/20.
The question wants to know who was the last, you know, between like James and Charles, who like people always get mixed up. So if you can get back to the Stuarts, who was later, James II or Charles II?
Yeah, I mean, you can.
I can hear Brent's eyes glazing over.
Yeah,
Scott, can you recite? There's a whole poem apparently, and some of the really big dicks would recite the poem at me. And
I don't know the poem.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have had total confidence, but I wouldn't have had a better answer than James. So I would have, you know, I would have gone with it. But
okay.
Full credit to you for getting on the show and getting 15 right and 0 wrong. Yeah. And it's so much luck. People forget how much luck there is in these games.
I mean, I knew the every single Final Jeopardy question for the rest of that entire week, but, you know, that and $2 is going to get me a ride in the subway, right? Yeah,
even Ed didn't even get it right, but Ed had the smaller bet. You bet almost everything, and
mathematically, Rob, that was the only thing I could
do. Yeah, I get it. And so ultimately, Ed walked away as a winner. But talk to me about the actual being on the set. You know, we have all these stories that we hear from Survivor, like, okay, what Jeff is like behind the scenes. Did you get a sense of what Trebek is like behind the scenes?
I was going to ask what Ed is like behind the scenes.
What is Ed like?
Ed is exactly like he is on television.
Nervous?
Yeah, well, here's the thing about going on a show like this is you make friends with all the people that are on for your week. Like, you're hanging out in the green room all day. You're not allowed to, like, bounce trivia off of each other. You have to talk about your lives, and you have to watch. You can't talk about what's going on. And so you kind of make friends with each other. Like, I have a friend that I made who played the day after me and also lost to Ed. And, you know, it's been 10 years. We're still Facebook friends. When he comes to town, we go out for bar trivia. And nobody in that room, by the time you get out there, almost nobody is nervous, because production staff does such a great job of taking care of you, making sure you're okay. Like, you know, they feed you, and they're just like such nice, wonderful people. They really make you feel like they really want you to do well. And so by the time you get out there, you've also played a couple of practice games. You're loose. You're ready for whatever comes at you. Everybody was having fun that day. Like, even the people that lost, everybody walks away from that experience on Jeopardy thinking, that was like one of the most fun things I've ever done. And Alex Trebek, very nice guy, but also stilted cocktail party conversation. That was about all I got out of him. I told him I'd had a crush on him since I was 5, and that kind of freaked him out. Mission accomplished.
Was he wearing pants that day?
Yes, he was wearing pants.
Because there was one episode that he came out not wearing pants. I think they cut that and then they reshot that, but that is a true story.
No, he remembered his pants.
It is so different on a game show than on a show like Survivor or Big Brother or Amazing Race or something like that, because you went out and the experience that you had on the show was probably pretty true to what you ultimately. So maybe things got cut out here and there, but I would imagine that the experience was probably pretty close to what you ultimately had, where it wasn't like, you know, Ed and Mary were talking about like, oh, like Jessica, what a bitch. I can't believe that. I really hate her. I really hate her guts. I'm just pretending to be nice to her. Right. Would you say, is that fair that what you experienced was close to what you saw on television?
Yeah, it all happened in real time. Like, they might've cut out a couple of ums or uhs, but it was really basically, I was out there for about 22 minutes, which is about as long as the episode is.
Yeah.
Were there any malfunctions during your game with the board or anything?
There was one point at which they had to re-record Alex saying the answer because there was noise in the background, but there were no actual malfunctions. No.
Because I've heard that like sometimes the screens like screw up or they reveal a clue too early. And everyone's got to turn around. The contestants have to turn their backs to the game board. And sometimes Alex will literally throw his shoe at the board.
Alex didn't throw anything at the board. There were some minor malfunctions while I was there, but nothing where they had to like sequester anybody or make them look away.
It's nice to be a game show host for a show like that, because you only have to have like a few comedy bits, and then you can do them every time because they bring in a fresh audience twice a day.
Yeah. All right. Jess, anything else on Jeopardy?
I think that about covers it for Jeopardy. It's really, like, I don't think I've ever had as much fun as I did on that trip. It was my first trip to California. I, you know, my parents flew down and watched it with me, and we went to Disneyland, and then I got to be on Jeopardy, and it was something I'd wanted to do my entire life, and I can't say enough good things about how much fun that experience was, even though I didn't win.
Yeah.
And even though some of you probably feel superior to me because I didn't win.
Jess, to me, that like I can sort of identify with that, with sort of like, you know, going out and playing like on the reality show. Like, yeah. I think for a lot of these people, like, it's easier to swallow the loss the first time out than the second time.
Yeah.
Because it's like, hey, I got to do this fun thing that I always dreamed about doing. And even if it goes badly.
I never thought of it this way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rob, we have a very similar track record when it comes to television appearances, don't we?
I'll say this. I had more fun watching your second appearance, Jess.
Oh, I'm sure everybody had fun watching my second appearance.
All right, well, we'll get back to your second chance in a little bit. Well, let's talk to Brent about his Price is Right experience, because I think it's going to be a bit different than what we'll talk about with you guys with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, too. So, Brent, now you go out to go be on the Price is Right, and I know that you are a Price is Right super fan, but there's no guarantee that you're gonna go there, but there's no guarantee you're going to get on the show, correct?
Well, there's a guarantee you're going to get in the audience because I had sent away
right, but
tickets.
Not that you're
going
to play.
Correct. But on the other hand, you know, I remember you talking with Jess and Scott about, you know, their casting process. Rob, to me, it was exactly the same thing because I totally plotted my entire adventure. Like, I knew exactly what I was going to say. I knew what I was going to do. I knew how things worked. Just so you know, I actually got on The Price is Right on my second time getting on. But the first time I got on, I really don't count because I was still in the Army at the time. And so I was wearing my uniform. And so I was like a stoic, butch version of the boy you see before you. And so they didn't pick that boy, thank God. They waited until I was out of the Army and I could be my normal gay self. And then I finally got on The
you
Price
went,
Right.
You got into the taping, but you didn't get called to Contestants Row the first time, right?
Right. Me and my friend Jerry, we went to California and I thought this would be great. I'll wear my uniform. Like I can do this. You know, I know what to do. And I just wasn't myself. And I think they could sense that, truth be told. And I didn't get on the show. But it was fun to watch and we got front row seats and it was very fun. And then the second time I went back, I was out of the Army and I went with my family and I made these shirts. And, the shirts don't really mean much, but they at least set us apart from other people. And you could tell from the shirts that I was a super fan. And so I knew exactly what to say. It's so funny that Jess says, you know, what can you think of that sounds interesting in 10 seconds? That's about how long you have on The Price is Right to impress the producers. It's not a random draw. They interview everybody out in the line and everybody gets about 10 seconds to try to wow the producer into picking them for the show.
Yeah, that's a really good point that you make about trying to game the casting on The Price is Right as they go down the line. And we'll post the link as well on the show page to Brent's appearance. And you can see his shirt, which is talking about the, what is it? The car game? What is that called? The game that you did with El Cheapo?
Oh, yeah, Money Game. Well, back when Bob hosted the show, there were a lot more isms. Bob had a lot more things that he did that you know that people like remember, like Loyal Fan and True, and the Check Game fiasco, and Punchboard. It's just all sorts of stuff that Bob had, you know.
Yeah.
I gave each one of my family members a shirt that basically referenced. I mean, I didn't have any Plinko. I didn't have any, you know, popular games on my shirt. I had like really weird offbeat games that when they looked at me, they would know, okay, this guy is a fan of The Price is Right. And we know if we put him on the show, he's going to know what to do. And I knew what to give them.
A little different than the reality casting, because I don't think it helps you that much to say to them, hey, I am the super fan, like to be in a shirt with like an airbrush Cochrane on your like, hey, pick me, look what I've got. I think that's kind of a turnoff there. But now, Brent, when you do this for The Price is Right, are you worried at all that they're going to pick your dad or pick somebody else in your party when you outfit everybody in these shirts?
Well, I wanted to make a statement when I came in, and little did I know that I don't think the shirts really had a whole lot to do with me getting picked. I think it was more that I was I was a caffeinated version of myself. You know, when I went on the show, I had enough nervous energy that I gave them what they wanted to see. Ironically, my sister also had a really good audition that day, and I knew if they picked my sister that they were not going to pick me. So once they picked me, I was like, you know, I told Lori, my sister, I'm like, you know, you really had a shot. And just so you know, Rob, 8 years later, when my sister went back to The Price is Right, I totally plotted with her how to get on The Price is Right when Drew was hosting, and she got on first time going back. So I know what I'm doing when it comes to getting people on The Price is Right.
Okay, so when you go through The Price is Right, there's a producer that comes down the line. Do they talk to your whole party at once? Or they talk to you individually, each person for 10 seconds?
They talk to you individually for 10 to 15 seconds. Like I said, you need to give them something that stands out from other people that other people won't say. You need to be a caffeinated up version of yourself currently. Like, don't say things that everyone else says. Like, don't talk about Plinko. Don't talk about the big wheel. Don't talk about the Showcase Showdown. Everybody says stuff like that. Don't tell them that it's your bucket list. That's the worst thing you can say. Do not tell them that this is your bucket list thing.
Why? That makes
them
mad?
All the time. Seriously. That is not, like, if you tell them that, they will move on to the next contestant. Seriously. You need to just find something about yourself that is interesting, that's going to make you animated and laugh and get across to the producers that you have the energy party atmosphere that they want for the show, especially now, even more so with Drew hosting than with Bob. Drew is very into the sort of party, you know, improv atmosphere. He likes really interesting offbeat things. Like, they do things on the show with Drew that they never did with Bob. So I feel like even more so now, you really have to set yourself apart if you want to get picked for The Price is Right.
Give me an example of something they do now that they would never do during the Barker era.
They do contestant searches now, and they do Big Money Weeks and Dream Car Weeks, and they have foreign cars on the show, and they play like once a week they would do like during Dream Car Week, they would have like an $80,000 car that was unheard of in the Barker era. Mm-hmm. The Big Money Weeks where every game was for cash. I mean, Bob would never ever do stuff like that. I mean, with Bob, it was one car during the first half of the show, one car during the second half of the show, and that was about what it was, unless it was like a primetime special or $1 million spectacular or something like that. So it's more interesting now prize wise with Drew, but I liked it more with Bob, I have to say, host wise.
Now, with The Price is Right, it's almost like there's two levels of it, because one, you have to get into the building, and then two, you have to be one of the people picked to play on the show. Now, Brent, how early do people need to get there? And is it first come, first serve for people who just show up there at CBS?
It is first come, first serve if you have a ticket. You have to have a ticket. If you can go to the Price is Right website. It's called priceisright.com/calendar. You can pick a tape date. You send away for your tickets, and then they will send you the tickets back. And by the way, you should always pick Price is Right tapes twice a day now. You should always pick the first of the two of the day, because what happens is if you, like, let's say you pick the first one and you don't get picked, and they can't fill up the studio on the second one, then you can get into that studio as well and hopefully be a contestant on that show.
Okay, so let's talk about, so the day that you went, how far back is this? What year is this?
I was on The Price is Right in March of 2002, and my air date was on April 15th of 2002. So I only had to wait a month from the time I taped to the time it actually aired.
And if you watch Brent's YouTube video, this Brent does a really good job. He annotated it and tells you a little bit of like what he was thinking. And so they call you down, you come down to contestants row, and you say you made a huge mistake when you got to contestants row.
Right. Well, just so you know, first of all, by the time they got to the, you know, Price is Right has six games a day, and they got to the fifth game, right before the fifth game, and I was already talking to my mom and dad about coming back the next day, because I thought, you know, I'm obviously not going to get picked. I thought I was going to get picked, and then they didn't call me right away. And I was like, you know, what happened? I had a really good audition. I felt really good about it. And then, of course, they call my name. I was literally ready to give up, and they called my name. And I go down in contestants row, and I'm with this girl that I was out in the line with. And I made a huge mistake, you know, relatively speaking, because, like I said, we're all show-offs here, and I blabbed to her that I was a huge fan of The Price is Right. And she had been in contestants row since the beginning of the show. She was the girl with the cowboy hat.
Mm-hmm.
And she had been, you know, bad bid after bad bid after bad bid. She didn't understand probability. She didn't understand number ranges or anything like that. So she knew that I knew what I was doing. And so when I got called to come on down, there was a grill. And the grill looked probably like, I mean, like seriously, the grill looked like $900,000. But I knew this grill. I knew what it was. I bid $2,000. And I knew it was like 21 something, but I bid $2,000 just to not bring any attention to myself. And she looked at her friends and she bid $2,001. And of course, the grill was like $2,100. And I will just tell you, if you watch the audience when I bid $2,000, the audience totally boos me. Like they're like, what the hell is he doing? It's not $2,000 for a grill. And of course, I was right. So I just literally wanted to flip off the entire audience and go, told ya.
Is that a recommended move to flip off the audience on Price is Right?
No.
Has anybody ever played it as the villain?
That is not. No, it's not a recommended move. What is a recommended move is to keep your mouth shut about how much you know about the show. Because I guarantee you, if I didn't tell her that I knew everything there was to know about The Price is Right, she would not have $1 me.
Yeah.
And then I would have gotten to play for a car instead of her. And she lost that game and I would have won it.
Okay, so you bounce back and then you actually win in the sixth and final game of the show. And you had to have been a nervous wreck knowing that that was your last chance, right?
Oh, I was. Yeah, because back then, if you got called to be a contestant on The Price is Right and you got called to come on down, even if you didn't make it on stage, that was it. You could never, ever, 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 ever be on The Price is Right again. Like, even if you didn't actually get on stage, if you were just in contestants row, that was considered, quote unquote, being a contestant. So I knew this is my one and only shot to get on the show. Now, when Drew ended up taking over as host, they changed the rules and, you know, loosened them a little bit. But I didn't know that at the time. So I knew that it was my one and only chance. And I knew what I was going to do. I knew I was going to $1 somebody. And by $1ing somebody, I mean adding a dollar to whatever somebody else bid.
And you actually, on the bid where you got to get up on the stage, you actually bid $2 and you $2'd an old lady. Did you feel bad about that?
Oh, that's low, man.
I did not feel bad about it because she was stupid enough to bid a dollar when she wasn't the last contestant.
You should have been $2 and given her an extra
right?
dollar.
Yeah.
There was this TV, and I had been, ironically, I had been pricing TVs because I was looking to buy one, and the two contestants who were first and second bid like $2,200 and $1,900, and I knew they were high. I knew they were high. And then the old lady bid a dollar. So it was like, I mean, I had to bid $2. I could not bid anything other than $2.
You know, with the rule changes, my understanding is that now if you're on contestant's row but you don't get called up, you're immediately eligible to go back and try to be on the show again. And that even if you get on and get to play the game, you're eligible again after 10 years.
I'm currently eligible to get back on The Price is Right. And believe you me, if I go back out to LA, I will be getting back on The Price is Right. And I guarantee you I will do it again.
Wow.
I mean, I know what they're looking for. I can't, it's so funny. I can't really put it into words, but I know what to give them when the moment hits and they say, Brent, tell me about yourself. I know what to do.
You know, it's interesting though, to me, that to hear all of you guys speak with such confidence about what to do, here's what not to do. Have you guys ever been approached by anybody about coaching to be on any of these shows, Scott?
I have not, but I'm perfectly willing to. My track record is like, 1 in 15 or something getting on these shows. And maybe we'll talk about it later. I was on Millionaire. I was supposed to be on The Chase about a year ago. And then the day before I was supposed to fly out, they had bought my ticket. They had paid for the hotel, and they canceled on me. Like, as I was just walking in to get my manicure so my nails would look nice on TV.
Wow.
Seriously?
Well, they were going to have me do a magic trick as like my, like meet the contestant thing. So there was gonna be a close up on my hands, and my hands are I'm like the lady with man.
No, hands. No, Scott, I'm not talking about your manicure. I'm talking about the fact they canceled on you.
I mean, look at these fingernails.
I don't care about your fingernails. Why did they cancel on you?
Probably because of my cuticles.
Probably.
Well, so the chase has a more limited prize budget than a lot of other shows. It's on a cable network, and they were giving away too much money because the chaser is British. He didn't know a lot of the American trivia. So my understanding is a lot of people get cut. I think towards the end of a production run, they overcast it, and then they cancel the smart people if they've given out too much money, and they cancel on the dumb people if they still have a lot left in the prize budget and they need more wins. Okay, so I'm hoping they had given away too much money and that's why they canceled on me. But maybe it's the other way around. I don't know. Maybe I'm fooling myself.
All right, so Brent, I want to talk about your pricing game that you got to play. You got to play a quite an iconic game. You got to play the cliffhanger game, which is one of many people's favorites. Of course, that's where the guy gets to climb up the mountain and you get to hear the yodel song going through it. And Brent, you did a fantastic job. Now, how bummed out were you when you saw that the prize you were playing for was a dining room set?
You know, I wasn't bummed out at all at the time. And even looking back on it, I'm not bummed out. I mean, of course, I would love to have played for money or a car or, you know, whatever. But I mean, I was so thrilled to meet Bob. I mean, I knew that Bob was going to retire soon. I think I was with Bob in his like 31st season, I want to say. Mm-hmm. So I knew, every year they were like, you know, is he going to retire this year? So I knew that he was going to retire soon. And it was such a pleasure to meet him and talk with him. And I really felt like he was a kindred spirit, honestly. In the few moments we got to talk, he could tell I was a real fan. And he really appreciated, like, you know, what I knew about the show and my general enthusiasm for it. So that's why you can hear us talking when they're describing the dining room.
Yeah,
and you can hear Bob cackling over in the corner. And that's what we're talking about, the fact that I told him that when I was a little kid, I always rooted for the mountain climber to fall off the cliff. Like, I always rooted against the contestant. And here I am now playing it. And I'm sure there's some little kid at home rooting for me to lose as well.
Wow, the circle of life.
Did you know, Brent, that there's a 100% way to win that game? Just completely unrelated. Do you read the Slate article about The Price is Right and game theory? It turns out there's a lock way to win that game.
Where'd you hear about that, Scott? Was it in the chat?
Well, I already knew about it. I, I, so someone else.
Well, I knew how to win it. I mean, like, first of all, the prizes go in ascending order. So, you know, it's if you give them 25, 35, 45, which is pretty much what I bid, you're going to win the game. I mean, there's no way around it.
There's 100% lock way that would have worked every time the game's been played over the last however 20 years or whatever. You bid $19, okay, and then for each successive item, you bid $11 more than the price of the first item. So you bid, okay, $19, first item's 25, then you bid 36 on the next one, and you win 100% of the time. Even when they've played the game on rare occasions for a car, you would have won a car playing that strategy.
Yeah. It drives me nuts, though, I have to say, because people will, like, they'll bid, $25, and they see that the item is $30. And, you know, you have to know that if you're watching The Price is Right, you have to know that the next item's going to be more than that. I mean, I realize these people are idiots, and that's the end, they get called on stage, and they have no idea what they're doing. But if you watch a little bit of a show, and you'll see that the prices always go in ascending order.
Yeah. So Brent, you did win the cliffhanger game, and of course, then you got to spin the big wheel. How big of a thrill was that for you to come in as the prohibitive favorite to win, as the person who won the most money in the second half of the show?
It was on his bucket list.
Yeah.
Yes.
Don't say that.
Right. Well, you know, you can. The funny part is that you can see me chatting with the girl in the cowboy hat. All is forgiven at this point.
Right.
We both made it on stage, and all is forgiven. And then, by the way, I don't even know. I even put in the annotations on my YouTube video. The boy who's up there with us, who eventually wins the Showcase Showdown, he's so boring. He was with a group of people. I don't even know how he got.
That seemed like a little bit like you were hating on that guy.
I don't understand how he got on the show. He was so bad. So. I don't know if they need, maybe they need to pick like one dull person to go against the fabulousness of me or something. I don't know, but like, I wasn't living for what he was serving.
Rob, is that why I'm on this podcast? Was I invited?
Yes. We need one dull boy to sort of offset the fabulousness of Brent.
And I will answer that the wheel is heavy. I thought I could get it around like 5-6 times. I barely got it around 3, and I was like jumping to spin at that thing. So it's very, very heavy. There's no way you can really game the system. Unless the only way you can really game the system on the wheel is if you're the first contestant and it starts on a dollar, you can sort of squeak it around and try to land on a dollar again. I've seen people do that. But when I went up to spin, like the wheel was in the middle of the wheel, it was like in the black area. There was no chance I was ever going to spend a dollar unless I just naturally did it.
I feel like that's going to piss Bob off too. If you're trying to game,
yeah, exactly. That's the thing. I didn't want to get booed. I didn't want to piss Bob
the
off
audience
after him liking me.
Hisses.
So you're living in the moment. Yes.
Shame. You're trying to game the big wheel.
Right. And they still do that too. They still boo the contestants.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as I was watching you spin the wheel. I wonder if like especially somebody who plays so much slot machines, is there any sort of thought into how much should I spin the wheel or just like go the hell for it?
Yeah, there was going into the show. I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm sure I can probably do this. But once you get on the show, the excitement is just, your body is just electric. Like you can't believe that this show that you watched since you're a little kid, you know, you're there now and you're with Bob and you're looking at the audience and you're on the show. It's like freaking crazy. And so you're just like, you just grab the wheel and spin the damn thing. That's basically what I did.
Right. One of the things I always hear about The Price is Right is that it's a little bit complicated the way that they do the prizes in terms of the taxes that you have to pay on what you win. Could you sort of just talk through what you had to do with getting the dining room set prize?
Right. Well, just so you know, any prizes that you win on The Price is Right, you cannot exchange them for cash. Okay, just so everybody thinks you can do that. That is not true. Whatever prizes you win, you can immediately decline. After you're done with your appearance on the show, they take you back into this little room and you can decline any prizes that you don't wish to have. Of course, I accepted everything because I wanted everything. And then they sent you, I think they have 3 months to send it to you from your tape, from your air date. So if my air date was April 15th, they have 3 months after that. And they send me everything in the mail. Literally everything came. And they set it up for you. So my dining room set, my big screen TV, the gold and platinum dinnerware, everything, they set it up when they came. The movers, they brought it all in and they set it up wherever I wanted them to. And it was a really, really cool experience. As far as taxes go, you do have to pay taxes.
Do you pay them there, or do you have to like just file them on your tax return?
Oh no, you just file them. Yeah, it's just like earned income is basically what it is. It's you get a 1099 or I think for it, and you have to pay California state tax And any federal tax you might owe. I ended up not owing that many things because my tax bracket was so low to begin with.
Yeah.
And I won about $8,000 worth of stuff. It didn't pull me into another bracket.
And people decline. So say somebody like wins like a jacuzzi, they like say, I live in an apartment.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, if you don't, you're going to have to pay taxes on it. So, you know, if you win this, you know, something you don't want that costs a lot of money that you don't think you're going to really be able to sell for much, people do decline prizes. But and I will tell you, my like as I said, my sister also got on the show and she won this like beachwear and towels and whatnot as her prize to get up on stage. Come to find out, after the show aired, they could not provide it to her. Like they couldn't find the prize. So they ended up sending her cash. She made out great. Like it was amazing that like she got this check in the mail from CBS for $1,200.
What else did
because
she
they couldn't give it? She played for a car. She played Spelling Bee, which is a really hard game to win. There's an element of luck to it. Even I couldn't win it every time, you know, 100%. And she lost. I'm just saying, you know, there are games that I can definitely win 100% every time. Spelling Bee is not one of them.
Yeah.
Spelling Bee, there's an element of luck.
You can't just bid $11 more.
Right. She made it to the showcase and she had a really, really good bid. And then this other lady had a really easy showcase and she bid a little bit better. Like my sister came within like $3,000, which is really good.
Did you guys have a viewing party when your price episode aired? Did you do anything special to watch it?
I mean, I was with my then partner at the time. We watched it. My family knew it. I sent out postcards to everybody. They get these postcards in the Price is Right gift shop. You can let everyone know you're going to be on the show on such and such tape date. I sent them out to basically everybody who I knew. But that was about it. Yeah.
All right. Well, Scott, I want to get into your millionaire story and we could tie that back into Jess's millionaire story also. Now, who appeared on Millionaire First between the two of you?
Oh, I remember watching Jess's YouTube video as I was preparing and saying, well, at least that won't happen to me. I do. I remember watching it. I mean, it's like that's the nightmare, right? Like it's
the nightmare.
It's
the
poetic.
The odds of that happening are it's one in like 12,000 something.
Well, I'll talk about it. I had a pretty rocky start myself that the numbers like suggest should not happen, but like just watching that, I was like, well, like it's you jumped over the two biggest money questions because the show doesn't at the time we were on, it was like during this like 5 year period. When the questions didn't increase in value, it was the first 10 questions where you'd get them in random order and they'd have random money assigned to them. So you wound up jumping over the $15,000 and the $25,000 questions. You were only opening you were only answering for the tiny amounts.
Wait, and then, Scott, didn't Rob ask you about your millionaire appearance?
it was like Faulkner wrote it. I mean, it was so yeah, you were first. I think that was the question.
That was the question.
And when did you appear, Scott?
I was on in 2012. I taped in September and it aired in November.
And Jess, when was yours?
I taped in November of 2011 and it aired in May of 2012.
Okay, so very close to each other.
Yeah, very close. Same era.
During the Meredith Vieira era, who I'm quite a big Meredith Vieira fan. I don't know if Jessica likes her as much as I do.
Oh, I love Meredith. She is
wonderful.
She's a top-notch woman.
Yeah. And now Cedric the Entertainer hosts the Millionaire. Is that right?
Rob, we'll get you up to speed. He was two hosts ago. Cedric did it the year after Meredith. And then it was Terry Crews for a year.
Terry Crews hosted Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
I get to go on Terry Crews.
No, you're messing with me.
That would have been amazing.
And now it's Chris Harrison from The Bachelor, not Chris Hansen from Dateline.
Wait, hold on. This is...
Have a seat. Have a seat in the hot seat. I want to ask you some questions.
Hold on. So I don't know what my mind is blown more about, Terry Crews or Chris Harrison.
So they tape the show out of order. Like they tape the whole season's worth of episodes in a couple months. So they don't know when they're taping, like when you're going to see an episode. So every single Terry Crews episode, since it could have been the first one that he was in, he always starts like, hey, I'm Terry Crews. You may know me from Brooklyn 9-11 or Brooklyn 9-9.
Brooklyn 9-9. Brooklyn 9-11 is a much sadder show.
Brooklyn 9-11 is not a show we watch.
Whatever the show is called. you may know me as Andy Samberg's giant friend. So every episode he had to start that way. And then he'd shake the contestant's hand and the contestant's hand would like disintegrate.
Yeah. Wow. So anyway, all right. So you guys were in the heyday of the Meredith Vieira era. Okay. And now I feel like that, well, let's just tell the Jess, let's let Jess tell the story since that we, you know.
Yeah, I feel like that's the best place to start.
I should not have done that, Jess. You go ahead.
It's speaking of like things bouncing out of order, it would be way too much. It would be like having all the high dollar amounts first to now not finish Jess's story.
I think we pretty much covered it, but I think every person that listens to anything that I've done for Rob as a podcast already knows this story because it's still on the first page of Google results when you Google me because someone thought it was such a horrible thing to happen to someone that they stuck it up on YouTube for the entire world.
Oh, that you didn't post that on YouTube? Somebody else posted that on YouTube?
No, I didn't post that on YouTube. I didn't even tell people when it was airing.
Okay.
Oh my God.
All right. So we'll post the embedded link if Jess is okay with that on the page so that you can have a frame of reference.
Everyone has seen this at this point.
No, I don't think so. I think there's a lot of people that are listening to this.
I didn't even know about it, actually.
You know, if they don't care for The Amazing Race, then they probably haven't heard too many things with you in it, so maybe they haven't checked it out. And I don't think we've talked about it on the Survivor podcast.
Four people have seen it.
Yeah. So, I watched it again today. I think I had seen it a while ago.
You've now seen it two more times than I have.
Yeah, I didn't think it was that bad of a disaster.
Well, the thing is, like, I didn't think it was either. Like, I thought this is going to be pretty unremarkable. Like, yeah, that was a really shitty turn of events. Like, you know, I blow the first two, like, I skipped the first two questions of the two highest dollar amounts. By the time I got to the question that 75% of the audience got wrong, I didn't have enough money that I could walk away and come out ahead. It was really pretty ridiculous. And I was not happy about it. I was trying to put on the face, but I think you know me by now, Rob. You know that I'm not a very good actress.
Yeah.
So I was like trying to do the fake smile and I was unhappy with the turn of events. I was angry. I felt like I'd wasted two vacation days to sit in a green room for 12 hours. Yeah. And
who
then
were you angry with? You were angry with yourself? You were angry with the producers?
I was angry with production a little bit. I realize now, like, it was just luck. It was rotten, terrible luck. But they pumped me up so much and they were making me feel like they really wanted me on the show and like they were really excited. Like, the guy was like, "I think you could go all the way." I'm like, "Yeah, you say that to everybody." And I felt really like they had kind of walked me into a trap because this is something Scott and I were talking about before we started recording. But I'm not going to go so far as to say that there's any kind of malice intended here, but they do assign you a deck of questions far before you are go up there. It's randomly. Not random. There's nothing random about it.
The questions are random, right? They randomly assign the deck of questions to the contestant, and that's done by legal. So they have, in any tape day, you probably had 10 people in the green room, plus however many holdovers were from the last date. So they've got 10 people, and they've got 10 decks of questions, and they randomly assign them. But then once they know who has which deck, they know which decks are tougher, and they know whose rotten luck means they're probably going to get blown up on the show. And so they try to structure it as best they can so each episode ends with a contestant either taking the money or getting a question wrong, because if you continue on to a second episode, that's two episodes they have to air sequentially, whereas if they break it up, they can move one episode that's a good episode into sweeps and keep a bad episode and like relegate it to when nobody's watching in the middle of the summer.
Right, exactly. So, and this is something like if you watch a whole bunch of episodes of Millionaire that are taped sequentially, you can kind of figure that out. And so I was somebody that they put on at the end of a day and they actually held me over for 2 days because I was local and I didn't have to stay in a hotel. So I was like the last person on the second day that had to go up and they wanted me out very fast. And so I was in and out very fast. And, you know, I felt like I was trying to redeem myself after coming in second place on Jeopardy. And that was the exact opposite of that. And I thought, well, good. I'll just forget the whole thing ever happened. I got over it pretty quickly. And then 6 months later it aired and it all came back again, because here's the thing about people that watch daytime quiz shows. People that watch daytime quiz shows are deranged.
They really care.
This comes up on YouTube and I have a rotten luck day. It's not even that I get things wrong that normal people would get right. It was just like all bad across the board. And it makes it onto YouTube, so it has a longer tail. People were watching this and feeling the need to contact me personally. And so for at least a month afterwards, I would get random messages from people. And I didn't even have a Twitter at this point. But I would get random messages from people saying, like, I can't believe you had such a bad attitude. You have no business being on television. And it was really, like, I wanted to forget it ever happened. I even, like, they sent out the notice, like, your episode's airing. And I said, you know how you were going to call my hometown paper? Don't.
Yeah.
I want to interject, though, and I don't know if this means anything coming from someone who you've not talked to before this evening, Jess. But as someone who watches game shows, who's been a long time fan of Jeopardy, a long time fan of Millionaire, there's nothing you could have done, right? Like, you're right. Clearly a very smart person. You got a horrible luck. The two questions you jumped over, I didn't know them. I don't know, like, who's one of them was about, like, the order of Boy Scout badges or whatever, Eagle Scout badges.
And nobody knows that.
I don't remember the other one, but, like, it's stuff that, like, you shouldn't know. You got really bad luck about the amounts you jumped over. There's a lot of pressure, so I certainly understand how one's attitude could sour at the, because when you're going on the show, you're thinking, I'm going to win all this money. You're not thinking maybe the million, but hey, I could win 50,000. I could win 100,000 if things break right, maybe 250, and it's crashing and it's burning. And then, there's nothing you can do on the question that you left on. The audience led you the wrong way on a question you didn't know the answer to, and you had nothing to lose. Why would you not answer the question?
Yeah, and you even hear me say.
But you weren't.
Yeah. Can we give the question just so for the people that are listening to the podcast know what we're talking about?
The song that is sampled in the Jay-Z song Empire State of Mind, what is the name of the band that recorded that song? And it was three semi-obscure 70s soul groups and the Delphonics, who had a couple of number one hits.
Yeah.
And I said,
Jackie Brown.
Yeah, I don't think it's the Delphonics, but I'm not sure what the other three of these are. And may I interject, when I was in college, I took a class in music of the 1970s, and I got an A in it. But we apparently didn't cover this. If I had phone a friend, I would have called my professor, and I would have gotten it right.
If only you would have taken British history instead of that.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't know. The class I got an A in, ironically, is the topic I fail out on. But I said, I'm going to ask the audience, but I'm pretty sure the audience is all going to pick the one band up here that everybody has heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, 75% of the audience, I'm like, I have nothing to lose. Fine, go with what the audience said. Oh, that's wrong. And according to somebody on the Television Without Pity boards, which were active at the time, they said, look at that psycho who looks like she wants to murder everyone in the audience on her way out the door.
You did, didn't you?
No, I didn't want to murder anybody, but I was not happy, and I couldn't muster the fake smile at that point. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to be done. And here's the punchline to all of this. I get done, I go through the spiel, like I have to sign a release because I showed a picture of one of my tattoos on the screen, and my boyfriend, who's now my husband, he says, okay, you could go back to work, it's like 1 o'clock, I'm gonna take you out to lunch and get you really drunk.
Oh,
so we go out, like, we go to Ollie's Noodle House right across the street from the studios. He orders a bottle of wine, and I drink the whole bottle of wine. And I'm looking at my Facebook, and I'm trying to delete, like, every reference to I'm taping Millionaire Today. And I scroll through, and one of my coworkers has posted something like, sorry to everyone who's gotten laid off today. It really sucks. I'm going to miss you. And I'm like, uh-oh. They laid off a third of the company while I was off taping Millionaire. So I call up my boss, and I say, hey, do I have a job to come back to? And she's like, yeah, but you need to come back to the office now.
Yeah.
So I'm drunk. I'm unhappy. I've just been humiliated for a million people. And now I got to go back into work. And the whole place is a ghost town because they just laid off a third of the company.
Yeah. Wow.
But other than that, how was your day?
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play?
Yeah, boy. New York, the concrete jungle where dreams are made of.
There's nothing you can't do.
Your mistake, Jess, was not missing, like, your second or third question, because what Millionaire does, not people who miss their first question, not people who miss their, like, sixth or seventh question, but people who miss their, like, second or third question, they cut from the episode and they're not on the show. They fill the time with a different contestant instead. So if you're going to crash and burn, that's the strategy, because then maybe nobody has to see it and you can pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah, but the big problem there is that you keep thinking, well, it's not going to be all terrible. The next thing's going to be something I'll get and I'll be able to make up some ground and it's going to be okay. And for me, it just was never okay. And I think the other thing I had going against me, and this is something I also run into on RHAP a fair amount, sarcasm and self-deprecation have no home in the game show world. Like, if you go on there and you say, yeah, it just doesn't play. Like, people were like, why is she so negative? Why does she hate everything? Why didn't they bring somebody on who'd smile? And it was, you know, it was a little humbling. I will give it that.
Just at the moment, did you get a sense from like production that they felt like that this wasn't going to play well on television, or was everybody there like, oh, this was great?
Yeah, I could kind of feel like they were treading a little carefully because I was obviously not happy with the outcome. And they didn't really like the guy that I was assigned to. He had been the casting guy and he was kind of my handler for the whole process. And he was very nice and he never stopped being nice. He never stopped being encouraging. He was like, well, you know, I'm sorry it worked out that way. You know, them's the breaks. What can you do? Nobody was blowing any smoke up my ass that it was going to be something that people were going to love to see. And it turned out it was something people loved to see.
And how was Meredith during all this? Was she sort of like comforting after? Or
she was very comforting. Yeah. She was so nice. Like, we went to commercial break and I'm like, this is the most insane thing I've ever seen on this show and it's happening to me. Meredith's like, I know, right? So she was cool. And she also sent me a handwritten thank you note afterwards.
Oh.
So I think she does that for everybody. I don't know if she actually wrote it herself.
She does.
But it came... Oh, she does.
Yeah, she writes the notes and someone else addresses them.
Okay. Yeah, I did notice the handwriting was different.
Envelopes are beneath her. Martha Stewart would have done the envelopes too.
Okay. Martha Stewart would have, like, you know, embossed the envelopes.
Well, she had more free time back then. She had a lot of free time back then.
True. True.
All right. Well, Scott, then let's discuss your millionaire experience, because we sort of have like the backdrop of Jess's where everything is going wrong. And your millionaire experience sort of started the same way, right? Once you got on the show.
So, yeah, but even before that, I think I had put so much pressure on myself that I was feeling it to an extent. Like Jess talked about Jeopardy being a fun day. Everyone there had fun. And I've done Quiz Bowl forever. I tried out for Jeopardy so many times, and this is my third time trying out for Millionaire. And I was at the point where, like, I thought I was never going to get on. I mean, the day of my tryout, the morning tryouts were full, and they gave me a number to come back in the afternoon. I was like, why bother? I'm not going to get on the show. And then I lost like $200 playing blackjack. And I was like, oh, I better come back to this casino and try out and make some money and get back this $200. But so in the time since I got the call, because with Millionaire, they send you a postcard after your tryout to say you're in the contestant pool. So I started studying and then they called me. I had like 11 days before we had to be in New York, the taping. And I crammed. I mean, I went through on the Millionaire message board. I went through every single contestant set of questions since they went to this format. So I had done everything I could to prep. I was ready. I knew what I was going to do with the lifelines. I knew about this thing called a secondary spike with Ask the Audience, where when you ask the audience, if there's one answer that has the majority of the people picking it, but there's a surprise like surge for an answer you didn't think people would like, that a lot of times that second answer is correct. And so you shouldn't trust Ask the Audience. So I knew like all this.
Secondary surge.
Yeah.
It's a real thing, Rob.
I've read about it. I read about it going into mine.
So I was like, all right, I'm ready. I know what I'm going to do. I know how to use the lifelines. And like, let's win like $15,000 and I can buy a car. Because at this point, my wife was about 4 months pregnant with our first child. So and that was part of why I got on the show, was because I was about to be a dad. Like, otherwise, there's nothing humanizing about me. So I'm out there.
Well, they really did like start talking about that. Like Meredith like brought it up out of nowhere, like in the middle of, you know, you're getting up to a certain question.
So, yeah. So, and then like, this is also like Jess said, she spent a couple days in the green room. You know, you get there the first day to give you a tour of the set. And then you're in the green room all day. When you're going to be a contestant, you don't get to watch
the Scott green room.
Yeah.
They named it after you, right?
Yeah. I should set them a plaque they could put up there. I was actually making balloon animals in the green room all day. So it was like all my nervous energy channeled into balloon animals because they thought they might want me to make one for Meredith on the show. So you're in the green room all day. You don't see what's happening. Like all these people one by one are getting called out and you don't know where they're going. You know, it's like in The Giver when like people leave the community and you don't know what's going to happen. It turns out they're just all being slaughtered. So the people are disappearing. You never see them again. So this is the second day in the green room. It's after lunch. And finally, all right, come on out. They isolate you. You're talking to a producer. You practice your stories you're supposed to tell on the show. And so when they finally call you out, like you've had like, you know, weeks of knowing you're going to be on the show. And it's just like every minute leading up to it is more and more concentrated. Like I'm about to be on the show. They bring you out there and now you're playing for real, and it's like suddenly all your preparation, you know, all your confidence that you have answering questions, reading on a message board, like now if you get one wrong, you're really out. Like you really don't get to have any money. So they asked me my first question. It was Bootsy Collins. Basically, the question was, with what genre of music is Bootsy Collins associated?
You didn't know that?
I did know it, actually. Okay. Thing. And I know he was involved with Fatboy Slim, and I was thinking about it. And so it's like, all right, it's funk. Like, it's got to be funk, right? But it's my first question. It's like the nightmare is don't miss the first question. So if it had been like my second question, if it had been like my eighth question, I would have gone for it. But first question, it's like, all right, let's get the first one done. So I ask the audience, and the audience comes back for funk with a secondary spike for country. And I'm like, oh, why? What's going on? So I wound up using my second lifeline. I jumped the question. Even though if I'd used no lifelines, I would have gotten it. I later found out apparently people who didn't know who Bootsy Collins was thought boot, country.
Yeah.
So I jumped $5,000. Then I got one right for $1,000. And then the next question was about who wrote the book Exile in the Kingdom, which is like something I guess I could have known having done Quiz Bowl, but I had like no idea. So I was out of lifelines after three questions. I jumped the $7,000 question.
And you said a line like, oh, it's so much easier at home. And Meredith like shut you right down. She's like, oh, are you saying you want to go home? Because we can send you home right now.
That was the moment. Like I wanted to like curl in the fetal position and like, all right, cut, shut off the cameras. I'm going back to Chicago, guys.
Like that was kind of cutting for Meredith, I thought.
It was. It really was.
She can be like that, really. Well, I've noticed.
So she thought I could take it. So before we started, I walked out on set, and there she is standing at the table. Hi, you know, how you doing? And she said, are you nervous? And I said, you know, most people probably say like, yeah, I'm a little nervous. And she comforts you. She said, are you nervous? They say, I'm a little nervous. I said, are you nervous? So she was like, all right, this guy can take it. So the beginning of my run, she was really giving it to me. And then when she realized that wasn't going very well, later when I could take it, she was being like super nice and like cautious with me. So, but after four questions, we went to commercial break. I had banked $1,500 and I had so much flop sweat on my forehead. They literally brought me a towel to like wipe the sweat off my face.
Like James Brown.
Listen, if you watch the clip, you can see before the commercial break, I am shiny. And after the commercial break, I'm matte. So that's the towel. So they bring out the towel. They brought me a glass of water. And then the stage director comes out and she says, just so you know, when you get one wrong, when you lose, you walk out that way and go up those stairs.
Oh,
wow. Well, thank you for the vote of confidence, stage director. That's very nice of you. Because they're like Jess said, they're trying to end the episode. I came in the middle of the episode. They're trying to end it. And so then what happened was I proceeded to get the next five questions right. Boom, 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 boom. And they finally cut and went to the next episode. But so like, you know, when your back's against the wall, you've got nothing to lose. So I had, like Jess said, you had so little money that like, if you had not answered your last question, you still get $1,000 just for losing. So there's no point not answering the questions. After five questions, and then again after seven questions, I had uncovered the least money possible after that amount of questions. So after five questions, I had banked $1,600. I could have walked with $800. Like I could have walked at that point with less than the minimum guarantee. And after seven questions, I had I think $6,600. So there's no reason to stop at that point. Like why lock up $3,300 when you know the next three questions are worth a cumulative $50,000 in real money? So I had the three highest dollar amounts sequentially as the last three questions I had in the round. So I had 10,000, then 15, then 25. And if you get out of round one, you get all your bank. If you walk in round one, you only get half of your bank.
Okay.
It was the rule in that format.
So before your $25,000 question, that was the end of an episode, right?
Yeah. So the last question of that episode was about which late night host teaches Sunday school. And I knew it. I think they thought it was a hard question. I think that's why they thought like that one would get me. But yeah, so I get that right. And then the episode ends. And
it was Stephen Colbert, for those of you guys who did not watch the Millionaire episode.
Yeah, and I've been thinking ahead of time, like, if I get a Stephen Colbert question, I can make a really great joke, and then I could be on the Colbert Report. You could, like, play the clip of it. And then it comes up, and I'm like, it's Stephen Colbert.
Why, do they often ask Stephen Colbert questions?
No, but I was just thinking, like, how, you know, can I make a moment go viral? Like, is there anything I can do? I thought that was an easy one. Give me something, like, that, you know, ties into Stephen Colbert, and he goes with, you know, when he was doing the Colbert Report, that stuff was, like, going. So anyway,
yeah, I was
so
always trying to get on the soup. Like that was my thing. I was like, you know, if I lose badly, maybe I can do something funny and I'll go on the soup. But
yeah,
was that what happened?
Living the life, being on the soup. That was real special.
Yeah,
you were probably on the soup a few times, right? I mean, Survivor was.
You know what? I think that Survivor, the Amazon All-Stars were on before, like in the era of, I'm not sure if there was soup in that time.
But it was like talk soup and they talked about talk shows almost exclusively.
Yeah, but I feel like between like 2003-04, I'm not sure if there was any soup. And then I think then the Joel McHale like reboot like started like 2004 or 5 or something like that. Like, I'm not sure. It might have been like a dark time for soup, but let's stick to the
world without soup.
Yeah. Like we're about to be in. So, all right. So then you come back and then do you actually go home overnight or Scott, or do they tape both episodes in one day?
Like Jeopardy, Millionaire tapes 5 episodes in a day, back to back to back to back to back. There's enough time between the episodes for everyone to change their clothes. I think Meredith has a changing room, like basically on set. And then for contestants, you go to like the hallway where the green room is on a separate floor. But before you even go there, they like radio up to the green room. They shut the green room doors. Everyone's locked in, so no one can see you coming through the hallways. So I got to go to the changing room, and I had to change my shirt and my sport coat. And the whole time on the elevator through the hallway, I remember thinking, like, all right, that was really brutal start. I have $31,600 in the bank. I can walk with 15-8. So don't take any chances on this next question. Like, I know it's $25,000.
The rule is you can walk away with half of what you have.
Right, until you get through the first 10 questions, because I've gotten through 9 at this point. Until you've gotten through 10, you can only take half your bank. After 10, you can take your whole bank.
And if you're wrong, so you get nothing.
Right.
$1,000.
We get $1,000. So I knew, like, this next question, I could walk with 15-8. If I get it right, I'm going to be at $56,600, which is one trivia question for more than $40,000. It's like, but 15-8 is perfect. Like, I wanted to win $15,000, go buy a car. So I'm just, like, trying, like, all right, just be confident. Like, if you know it, go for it. If not, like, hey, that's what a turnaround from like being in a horrible spot to a very respectable win mm-hmm. on the show. So we get back out, we get down to set. And when you're on the set, there's a nervous energy just being on the set. Cause in those, they moved the set to Connecticut since then. But when it was in the New York set, it was the same space where the Regis show was. It's the same studio. It's actually like right next to where they taped The View, in the same building there. And the set is like a round set, even on the outside of it. So it's like a giant warehouse kind of room. And in the middle of the room is the set. So you walk around the outside of the set to get around. And you see like the back of the giant screen where the questions are. And you see all the people with all the electronic equipment, and they mic you up. And so it's like you're like entering like the cauldron of Millionaire. You know, like you feel the flame rising as you're going out there. That sound right to you, Jess?
Yeah, that sounds right to me. And
okay.
The icing on the cake is I now work like across the street from there.
So they bring me back out there. They want me to do a magic trick for Meredith because it's ahead of time. They were like, you can do a magic. You're a magician. Do a magic trick. It'll be great. And this is like the worst time in one's life to do a magic trick. Like, hey, you're about to get a trivia question for $40,000. Do a magic trick first. So I go on set. I start the episode. I do the silly little magic trick. And then the question comes up. And as you're watching the episode, you can see the moment like that I realize, like, oh my God, I know the answer. And I'm like, 100% on this. So I go through it. Like, I go through all the choices just to make sure. And one of the pieces of advice I got from someone I knew who had lost on the show years earlier was never say final answer. Say what your answer is. Let Meredith say, is that your final answer? And then you say yes, because that gives you an extra like 5 seconds to not make a stupid mistake. So I'm going, all right, it's gotta be. Yeah, that's gotta be it. And then when I got it right, like that's like euphoria, like you can't imagine.
What was that question?
Yeah, let me interject here really quickly that if you've never seen Scott's Millionaire episode, like you totally should, because I watched it and I was totally enthralled by it. Like, I mean, because you, like, he didn't really tell me, I mean, you guys are spoiled by it now, but he didn't tell me how it was going to end. So I didn't know if you won anything or if it ended horribly or, you know, what happened. And like, as you get to the last three questions, like he keeps running over to kiss his wife and it's really cute. And I like, it's just a really, really, really sweet episode. So Scott, I love your Millionaire appearance. And Jess, I love your Millionaire appearance too, but just for different reasons.
So yeah, I mean, yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, it's fun. And I, after we taped, I didn't tell anybody, my wife and I didn't tell anybody how I did, because I had to suffer through it in person. Like you're all going to suffer through it watching it.
Well, what was your $40,000 question that you got?
So it was a $25,000 question that was worth 40, and it right. was before. Actually, I have it here, so I can actually read you the question. Before it was colonized, 17th century cartographers used the Latin term for southern to name what continent? Africa, Australia, America, Asia.
And your reasoning for that was pretty good, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, like just off the bat, If you had to take a guess on it, I think most people probably would guess Australia. But based on the timing, based on 17th century, you know, what hadn't they known about previously? And also, like, what limited Latin I knew. I know the Latin word for southern. So that made it, like, I was like, oh, yeah, and I know Aurora Australis is the southern light. So there you go. So I knew it was right, before she told me. But hearing it is like, you know, that was it. You know, I was good at that point.
Okay. Then what were you able to ultimately walk away from with Millionaire?
Yeah, so I had $56,600. They showed me the $100,000 question, which is another one that I felt like not should have known, but it was something that like I reasonably could have come across. So it was like, why didn't I read that somewhere? And like Jess with Jeopardy, anytime people always like, hey, what's the question you didn't know? And then I tell them, and they tell me, they're like, oh, that's got to be like this, and I'm like,
So. Yeah, Rob did that to me, so now I want to know what the question was.
Okay, I'll tell you, Jess. You don't know what it is, right? You didn't watch it?
No, I didn't watch it.
Okay. So the $100,000 question. After years of debate, in 1837, the U.S. House of Representatives officially banned members from doing what during sessions? Smoking tobacco, bringing pets, drinking alcohol, wearing hats.
You know, I don't know that one, so, you know, you can feel...
No, take a guess. Everyone else does. No one else. I mean, if I'd gotten it wrong, I would have gone down to $25,000. So it's easy to guess on it. We don't have $31,000 to lose, but go ahead.
Yeah, that's probably true. I think I have run across this at some point. I mean, wearing hats is the stupidest answer.
Yes.
You going with that?
That's my final answer.
See, I hate you because you're one of the people who got it right with nothing on the line and who knows it, just like I knew King James. So
we're even.
There you go.
There you go. All right. If you guys could have maybe just teamed up, maybe that's why Jess likes The Amazing Race so much, because you get to have a teammate if you don't know something.
Although, Rob, I got to throw this in. This is only tangentially related to my Millionaire appearance, but I have to tell a little story to the listeners, five of whom care about The Amazing Race. But so my episode airs in May 2012, and I spend the next month getting rabid hate from people that take their Millionaire very, very seriously. And I was pretty depressed all summer. And then late summer, I'm talking to my boyfriend and I say, you know, this podcast I listened to, he's looking for somebody to cover The Amazing Race.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds kind of cool. I don't know that I want to put myself out there again. And he looks at me real serious. He says, you need to do this. You need to apply for this because you need to shake off this bad juju that you got from being on television, and you need to go out and do something good.
Yeah.
And so I sent in the application, and for some reason you picked me to do it. So.
Right. Wow. This is the Jessica origin story.
That's the origin story. That's how
this was like the lost flashback episode.
Yeah. If I had not been basically cajoled into sending you my application after my boyfriend said, I want you to stop moping about your Millionaire appearance. Yeah. I may not have ever been on Rob's podcast.
Oh, wow.
Wait, so you're saying that if I traded in $56,600, I could co-host podcast with Rob?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, but you can only co-host them about the show that nobody cares about.
Pass. The money. By the way, Rob, what are we getting paid for this one tonight?
Okay. Well, we'll see. I got a question to answer. Then hold on.
Okay.
I think questions. You got a question to answer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. So then ultimately, now, Scott, what is your next game show that you have in your sights? Do you have something else that you want to move on to next?
Jeopardy is my dream. Like, that's the one that I want to... Like, Jeopardy is bucket list. Sorry, Brent. Jeopardy is my bucket list game show, and I really want to get on it. But Jeopardy requires so much studying and so much preparation. I am going to be taking the test this week, but I'm not at my peak trivia powers like I once was. So right now, it's Price is Right, which I watch with my two-year-old quite a bit. And I'm actually going out there this week, which is where the idea for this podcast came from. I thought, like, what's a good way to get Brent to talk to me for, like, an hour about how I can get on Price is Right? So I'm really excited about that, and I'm gonna try to win a new car and, like, $25,000 and a dining room set and whatever else. So whatever other goodies are out there.
Wait, so the whole reason you want to do this podcast, the whole backstory for this was just a scam so that you could talk to Brent about you picking his brain for how to get on the Price is Right?
That'd be a better story. No, but that's where the idea came from, was thinking it was like, who do I know was on Price is Right?
All right, Brent, okay, quick.
And Jess was on two shows, and Rob's looking for stuff to do, and
Yeah.
All three of us are like capable of speaking English. So yeah. Like all a fit.
So Brent, quick, give Scott the advice. What's the killer piece of advice that Scott needs to do to get onto The Price is Right?
I just think he needs to hype himself up. I think he needs to don't talk about bucket list that you've always wanted to do this. Everyone says that. Talk about something interesting about the show. Pick a weird game. Like, I mean, come on, Scott. You know some of the weird games that they have on the show.
Should
like
Scott do a magic trick?
Time is money. Magic trick, maybe. You know, Drew's into stuff like that now. So that's not a bad idea if you can do it really fast. But you've got about 10 to 15 seconds. I really think, though, you're going to need to talk while you do the magic trick. So if you can get all that information out there as quickly as you can and, you know, like I said, be a caffeinated version of Scott, then I think you'll have a good chance of getting on the show.
Great. Well, what do I owe you? 10%, 20%, 80%?
No. I would just be happy if you text me and say I got on the show, I'll be absolutely thrilled. By the way,
on the record, you're not going to get a percentage.
Right, exactly. I just want to tell you really quickly, if you do happen to get on the show, and if you're one of the first four contestants, and I know you think, oh, this could never happen, but I gave my sister advice, and she was one of the first four contestants. There's only nine people called, and the first four are like basically 50%. If you get called, make sure you bid high on the first bid, because like they never want to stop the show for an overbid on the first prize. So whatever prize they show you, I guarantee you it's like most likely over $2,000. Like bid high.
Bid high.
I like it.
Okay. All right. Well, this has been so much fun to talk about all these different game shows that I would love to one day be on a game show. That's ultimately, I guess, how I got to Survivor and Big Brother, because I felt like, oh, this is like a game show, but it lasts for a long time. So it's not like I'm on it for just like one day.
Yeah. What did you make in 39 days on Survivor? 38 days. Yeah. 38 days on Survivor.
38 days altogether. Probably only a little bit better than you did in about 10 minutes on Millionaire.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I made half as much in 20 minutes in an air-conditioned studio in New York.
Yes, but I'm still collecting on that. It was like an annuity that I got paid out over 15 years.
Touché.
Right. By the way, I just want to say really quickly about Price is Right. You know, like I said, go to their website, and you definitely want to go when they're having the big money week or the special weeks where they give out the really big prizes, because a lot of people don't know about that. I mean, only like the really true fans of Price is Right understand the way the show works. And like I said, always pick the earlier of the two appointments so that you can have a chance to go to the second taping if you don't get picked for the first taping.
Okay. All right. Well, very fun stuff all around. I feel like we got to go with the hashtag secondary surge. I think that's got to be what people are going to take away from this. All right. Let's tell people if they want to keep up with you guys or ask some questions about their own game show questions. Of course, you could follow Scott. Scott, how do people check out the Genius Podcast?
Sure. You go to geniuscast.podbean.com. You can also search for Genius Cast in iTunes, and you can follow along that way. I'm also on Twitter at Who Is Scott Green. Again, big Jeopardy fan at Who Is Scott Green.
Nice to have a short name to do that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, well, you could, Who Is Rob C. probably is available.
Yeah.
Although not anymore, because most people find this, there is going to be your parody Jeopardy Rob account.
Oh, yeah, that'll be huge.
If you're in Chicago, you can look up thegreatscott.com. I'm available for all sorts of events. There's going to be children, birthday parties, libraries, circumcisions, whatever you got. I'll do a magic show.
Wow. Make a foreskin disappear?
I'll turn it into a five skin.
Yeah. You're not going to make a balloon animal out of it, are you?
Not at my rate. No, that's a whole other level.
I don't know you people right now.
This is horrifying.
All right. Of course, Jessica, you could hear her all season long on Rob's podcast and talking about The Amazing Race and on reality TV for Hap Ups. You can follow Jess on Twitter. She's at Haymaker Hattie. But Jessica also blogs for previously.tv. People may not know that.
Yeah, I think most people probably don't. And this is something we talked about a little bit earlier, but I've coached up like four or five people that have gone on Jeopardy. It's something apparently like several of my college friends went on to be on the show. So it's something I'm happy to give people advice on if they want to hit me up.
Okay. All right, Scott, you should talk to this one.
Yeah, I may well do that. I mean, it's test day for me tomorrow.
There's two shows you want to go on. This was like, we did like a whole workshop just for you, Scott.
I'll go on any game show. I mean, I tried out for 500 questions last year. I, like I said, The Chase, I came very close on. Wheel of Fortune, I would love to do. So, you know, I'm there. But a lot of the stuff we talked about, because I've read a lot about this. I mean, my handicap is that I'm a 32-year-old white nerd, and that's who tries out for these shows. But a lot of the same strategies apply, of like being the biggest version of yourself and giving them the elevator pitches and all that stuff. So if you can do it for one show, it gave me hope. Being on Millionaire, like, reignited the flame. And this is my first time trying for Jeopardy since Millionaire, that like maybe I can do it.
You mentioned Wheel of Fortune. Do game show snobs look down their nose at Wheel of Fortune?
No, Wheel of Fortune is a legit show. I mean, there's a lot of luck on Wheel of Fortune, but there's a ton of luck on Jeopardy too. I mean, you know, take someone like Jess, who I know is a really strong trivia player. She's in, this will mean something to like 2% of you out there. She's an A-Rundler on Learned League.
Oh.
She's very strong in Learned League. And you know, you give her a different set of questions. If Ed's thumb was broken that day, you know, there's like a million different, just a few different categories. And she could have been a 5-time champion going to the Tournament of Champions. So, but the Wheel of Fortune has an even higher luck component than even Jeopardy, just because the wheel can destroy you.
Scott says you don't look down your nose at Wheel of Fortune, do you?
Of course not.
Okay.
No, I will tell you, Rob, I don't look down my nose at Wheel of Fortune. In fact, I am trying out for Wheel of Fortune. Like, I'm putting together a video as we speak. Like, it is possible to get on Wheel of Fortune with an online video and then take the test.
You got it.
I know people who have done it. So, like, I'm totally plotting to do it. By the way, I also wanted to tell you guys, just so you know, $100,000 pyramid coming back.
It's coming back.
Michael Strahan is hosting. It's going to be taped in New York City. And you bet your bottom dollar I will get my ass on that show. I will find a way. I love Pyramid. I live for it.
Did you guys see the other day when somebody tried to say the same answer that somebody already said on, and Pat Sajak was really snippy with them. I think they said it was homemade waffles. Somebody guessed, and then the next person guessed homemade waffles.
My friend was on that episode. Hans von Walter is a buddy of mine. He was the first guy to answer homemade waffles.
And Pat Sajak was like, still, no. I'm pissed.
Rob, I'm fading out a little bit, so I wanted to say really quickly, you can find me at One Lucky Gay, and you can also find me on YouTube at Brent's Lucky and Gay Slot Channel. It's mostly slots, but it's me, and I'm the gay part. So have fun. Try to find me if you can, and say hi.
All right. Well, everybody, thanks so much for doing this. This was a blast to get to talk about game shows, and I think a lot of people who are interested in this probably got some really useful information. So well done, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Glad to be here.
All right. Take care, guys. All right, everybody, there you have it. That's our game show roundtable here on Rob Has a Podcast. Thanks so much to Scott and Jess and Brent for sharing their stories. Very fun for a game show nerd like me. And of course, we are getting ready for our own big game show. The Survivor Family Feud is coming to RHAP. Look for an announcement on that very soon, on the date, where we're going to have two teams of ex-survivors squaring off in a Survivor Family Feud game live on a webcast or Google Hangout. That's how we're going to do it. Not in person, basically, is what I'm trying to say. So very excited for that coming up here in the next couple of weeks. Plus, we've got so much more to do here in February as we continue the march towards the return of Survivor. We're going to have our Nicole and my cast preview. Corinne is coming by to do her brutal cast assessment. All of the preseason stuff that you expect from Rob as a Podcast, all coming up here in the next couple of weeks. Got a fun podcast as well coming up with Gordon Holmes. The last couple of Januaries on the podcast, we have cast an all-star season of Survivor. And this time around, we are going to cast our official Third Time's the Charm cast. 54 players have tried twice and lost, just like Jessica, in their first two times out, have been unsuccessful in winning the big prize. But out of those 54 people, we will cast 20 of them in an all-star Third Time's a Charm cast here on Rob as a Podcast. So don't miss any of it. Subscribe to the podcast. Go to robasawebsite.com/iTunes or search for Rob as a Podcast in your favorite podcatcher. Plus, we've got News AF this week, so all sorts of good stuff. If you missed our Jeremy Collins interview, that's up on robswebsite.com as well. So looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say in the comments of this show. And of course, we'll have all of those links to Brent and Jess and Scott's appearances on the game shows. And we'll talk to you again soon. Take care, everybody.